Thank you, Mr. Young. This is my first opportunity to address you from this stage since the pandemic hit so many months ago. I've presented a few times on Zoom, probably not so much to you, but to Redlands. And as you know, I was running the Zoom meeting last week. And so, because I haven't been here very much and only recently started showing up, and many of you may not have noticed that for the better part of last month, I was absent. And it wasn't because I was staying home from COVID, it was because my mother passed away. And while it was sudden, at the age of 98 and a half, it could hardly be viewed as unexpected. We were sad, but we did not go through the profound grieving that so many of you have had when you've lost a loved one. Still, this had a sobering effect on me, and it's been difficult to put together a message that isn't somehow related. I'm reminded of what the preacher had to tell us in the book of Ecclesiastes. Chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes, in verse 2, he says, "Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart." Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. And it was in this context that I was reading through Acts 7, which is the martyrdom of Stephen, the first man described in Scripture as dying following Christ's resurrection. And the account concludes with this interesting statement that is easy to overlook. In Acts 7, the last two verses of the chapter, 59, they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God and saying, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." Then he knelt down, cried out with a loud voice, "Lord, do not charge them with this sin." And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Luke does not record that Stephen died. Not in those words. Luke, the beloved physician, says he fell asleep. This is a profound concept, but one which is emphasized over and over again in the Scriptures. So in light of what I and my family have gone through, today I'm going to look at how the Bible, indeed how our Father in heaven, views what we call death, what to God is nothing more than a sleep from which he will one day wake us. Perhaps no one expressed this idea more than Jesus Christ himself. In Luke chapter 8, we find an interesting story. It's represented in all three of the synoptic gospels, but we're going to look at the version Luke 8, written by the same man who described Stephen as falling asleep. And in Luke 8, chapter 41, we read, "And behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was a ruler of the synagogue. And he fell down at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter, about 12 years of age, and she was dying." Jesus goes with the man. They were delayed a bit on the way as another remarkable healing took place in a woman that had been suffering coincidentally during the very same 12 years that this little girl had been alive. In verse 48, Jesus confirms the woman's healing, and we continue, and he said to her, "Daughter, be of good cheer. Your faith has made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking, someone came from the ruler of the synagogue's house saying to him, "Your daughter is dead. "Do not trouble the teacher." But when Jesus heard it, he answered this ruler of the synagogue, saying, "Do not be afraid. Only believe, that she will be made well." When he came into the house, he permitted no one to go in except Peter, James, and John, and the father and mother of the girl. Now all wept and mourned for her, but he said, "Do not weep. She is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him, knowing that she was dead. But he put them all outside, took her by the hand, and called, saying, "Little girl, arise." Then her spirit returned. She arose immediately, and he commanded that she be given something to eat. Was the girl dead? As the people knew was the case, Luke was a physician, and he seemed to think that she was dead in his narrative. And yet Jesus said she was not dead. She was sleeping. Was he lying? Was he mistaken? Of course not. But he was more attuned to the reality of the situation than anyone there. For us, death seems so permanent. To Jesus, it was merely a sleep from which she could be awakened at any time of God's choosing. It may have only been a matter of hours in this case, but sometimes it was longer. And so turn with me to another account in the book of John, John chapter 11. And we know this to be the account of Lazarus. And beginning in verse 1 of John 11, "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sister sent to him, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick.' When Jesus heard that, he said, 'This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it.' Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he went immediately, didn't he? No, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. And after this, he said to the disciples, 'Let us go to Judea again.' The disciples said to him, 'Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again?' 'Well, lately was only the previous month or two.'" He'd gone to Jerusalem during the Feast of Dedication. This was probably only a month or two after that. And they had tried to stone him then. A couple months before that, at the Feast of Tabernacles, they tried to stone him there too. So these disciples had reason to be concerned. But Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." These things he said, and after that he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up." Then his disciples said, "Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get well." However, Jesus spoke of his death. But they thought that he was speaking about taking rest and sleep. Then Jesus said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him." To Jesus, looking at death as sleep was very real. He awakened several during his brief stay on the earth. People that others had considered dead. A term that we use when we as humans can no longer be awakened by anyone other than God. But it was also real to Jesus because he knew what would happen only about 1 month later. He would be tortured and crucified, and he would be put to death. No, he would fall asleep. And 3 days later, the Father would awaken him. Continuing in John 11, we'll go to verse... First I want to make a few more comments. What was death like for these people who were described as sleeping? We all sleep at night. We generally aren't aware of what is going on when in deep sleep, but we often partially emerge from that state and experience dreams. Some of you may have gone through a surgical operation in the past where you were put to sleep with anesthesia. I experienced this a few years ago when I had a hernia repair surgery. I remember climbing onto the operating table on my own power while several people milled around strapping things to me. One I knew was the anesthetist. I remember wondering what it would be like as I was put to sleep and how long that process would take. That's the last thing I remember before opening my eyes. The room was different. I saw a nurse walk by and look over to me and noticed that my eyes were now open. She came over briefly to check on me. Then she went to get something for me to eat and then left to get my wife. What was it like for Jairus' daughter? I was not in pain before my surgery. Was that 12-year-old suffering before she fell asleep? A few hours later, she woke up, just like I did. Any pain was gone. A man she had probably never seen before was holding her hand and telling her to get up. As she looked around the room, saw three other strangers, she also saw her father and mother, who probably were soon reaching out to hug her, most likely with tears in their eyes. And, like was done with me, they gave her something to eat. Lazarus had a little less comforting experience at first, and we will now continue with this account in John. And I'm going to start reading in verse 17. So when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was sitting in the house. Now Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." I think she was dropping a subtle hint. And Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Might have been encouraging, but Martha wasn't quite so sure how she should take this. And she said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is to come into the world." And when she had said these things, she went her way, secretly called Mary, her sister, saying, "The teacher has come and is calling for you." As soon as she heard that, she arose quickly, came to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the town, but was in the place where Martha had met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, "She's going to the tomb to weep there." Then when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Obviously, they are sisters. She said exactly the same thing that Martha said. Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews that came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and he was troubled. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." Some of them said, "Could not this man, who had opened the eyes of the blind, also have kept this man from dying?" Jesus had done this in Jerusalem 4 months earlier, healing the man who had been born blind. Many of them had witnessed this or knew of the man. Then Jesus, again groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, "Lord, by this time there's a stench, for he's been dead 4 days." It's commonly accepted that a body can survive without refrigeration or embalming or something for maybe up to 3 days before it starts going completely bad. That may have been why Christ said to have not seen corruption, because he was only in the grave 3 days. But Lazarus had been there 4 days now. His body has started to decompose. And Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?" Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me." And then in verse 43, when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." So let's change our focus for a minute. Let's go into the tomb where Lazarus is lying there. He may have known that he was on his deathbed. He might have known that he could die. As with me, he was not aware of the fact when that happened. But suddenly his eyes open up, and he looks around, and what does he see? Absolutely nothing. Why? He was in a cave. Not only that, but in verse 44, we're told that his face was wrapped with a cloth. All he can do is hear a voice, a very familiar voice from his friend, Jesus, who said, "Lazarus, come forth, come out of that cave." And he's trying to figure out, and how am I supposed to do that? Because my legs are bound. I can't walk. I can't untie the bindings because my hands are bound. So he either somehow struggles to his feet or comes off of the slab that he's on or whatever, and he scoots or hobbles or whatever out of the cave. And when he arrives at the doorway, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, it says, and his face covered with a cloth, Jesus says to the people around him, "Loose him, let him go." And they rush up to Lazarus, and he's finally able to see them, greet his friends. They probably give him something to eat, and they sit down and explain to him what's happened in the last 4 days since you last fell asleep. What about those who are going to be in the first resurrection? What will it be like for them? For us, we hope. Paul describes some of that. He does so in a couple of places, but we're going to go to the account in 1 Thessalonians first. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And beginning in verse 13, Paul says, "I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep." Once again, he does not use the term died in this case. He says, "Those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring those who sleep in Jesus." He'll bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. Verse 15, "For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep." Then he explains what happens in verse 16. "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first." They are going to wake. Most likely, the ones there to greet them will be some of the angels sent to reassure them and escort them. Because in verse 17, it says that we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. Paul elaborates on this even more in 1 Corinthians 15. We know this is the resurrection chapter, so we know what the subject is going to be. He starts out describing the crucifixion of Christ and the fact that he rose the third day. He started to be seen by Cephas, and then the 12, it says in verse 5. In verse 6 it says, "After that he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to this present, but some have fallen asleep." After this, he goes into to discuss the surety of the resurrection, the fact that Christ being resurrected is an example for us, and this was done partly to assure us that there is a resurrection and that their preaching is not in vain. That those who have fallen asleep, as it says in verse 8, have not perished. In verse 35, he says, someone will say, "How are the dead raised up? With what body they come?" After all, Jesus had been raised after 3 days. He was raised in the same body he died in. Even Lazarus presumably had roughly the same body that he died in. What about all these people that have died and their body has decayed, decomposed, perhaps burned up in a cremation, or somehow it's lost? What's going to happen? How do they get a body? Paul goes on to explain, says, we have the example of grains planted in the ground. You know, they grow up, they get a new body. He says, don't worry about it. God will take care of it. And how does God do that? We've been told about the spirit in man. We know that apparently all of our conscious thoughts have been recorded in this spirit that goes to God. We heard reference of the spirit of the little girl returning to her, and Stephen had said, "Receive my spirit." So that God, there's a spirit in man, seems to record these thoughts. How do we get a body back? Well, that's even simpler. We all start as one cell. There's not much that we need to recreate their body. Even that cell is more than necessary. Even that cell is one molecule. It's a big one, mind you, but it's one molecule. The DNA molecule contains every bit of information needed to completely recreate in exactness the human body. Does God need that little molecule? No. We've gone through and we've managed in our modern day to be able to sequence this entire DNA molecule. We can record in digital form this entire code. We could print it on a piece of paper if we needed to, although the molecule is a lot smaller than that piece of paper. God can record this, perhaps stamped in the same spirit that he's kept with him all his years. Puts in a human body when a baby is born or conceived. Put a little stamp in there that says, here's what the DNA looks like. He can recreate you anytime he wants without even having to remember what you look like. What's nice about it is the human body that has grown old and decayed is looking kind of worn out. My mom didn't look too great when she was on her death's door. But that DNA knows what you looked like when you were in your prime. You know? So when God recreates the human body, hopefully you won't look like you did when you were on death's door. Then we get down to verse 51. And we read this verse that sometimes put, just in total contrast, sometimes they put it in front of a neonatal nursery up in the hospital. All those newborn babies are crying, some sleeping. It says, "Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed." Now, I'm sure that's not what Paul had in mind when he did this. He was referring to people who have died in sleep and the fact that everyone who's resurrected in the first resurrection, as described in 1 Thessalonians, shall be changed. He says, "In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised, they'll wake up, they'll be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed," meaning those of us who are alive, because Paul was certain that he would still be alive when this happened. It's a lot simpler when God, during the first resurrection, because there's nothing really said about having a physical body. So while God might use this DNA to recreate what you look like, he doesn't have to create a body. It's a little harder for the second resurrection. Not too hard for God by any means. But there are a few challenges. How many people have lived on the earth? Some population estimates, fairly official ones, although how they know I don't know, are there's maybe 100 billion. 100 billion people. Are they all going to be resurrected at the same time? Could be. My personal feeling would be rather chaotic. All these people coming up all at once, they all have to have some food, they all have to be attended to. These people are going to wake up. And they're not going to know where they are, how they get there. Last thing they remembered was what? Some guy stabbing them, maybe? But they're going to wake up. And it's going to take some time. They have to spend a little time with these people to explain to them what's going on. This is entirely speculation on my part. But the only thing that it says in scriptures about the second resurrection is that it didn't happen until 1,000 years are finished. It doesn't say how long it will be. It doesn't say how many people will come up at once. So I'd like to suggest that maybe it won't be all at once. Maybe it'll be done in order. Maybe God will choose certain nations first. There's talk about the Israelites, you know, being converted first and then later on, the Gentiles. My favorite idea is that it might be done based upon the principle of the last should be first. And the people will be resurrected in sort of reverse order in which they died. The reason I like this thought is because while perhaps God or Christ may be there, and this is one reason why I think it may not be all at once, they may actually be there to greet everyone who's awakened. Maybe it'll be one at a time. Create a body, put the spirit back in them, give them the breath of life. They wake up and Christ is there, just like with the little girl, saying, "Welcome back." But I'm kind of also thinking, if you resurrected people in reverse order, then the people who are waking up could be greeted by the same people who they had said goodbye to when they fell asleep. And as with the young girl who awakened and saw her father and mother there, maybe friends and family and other acquaintances will be there to welcome people as they are resurrected. Maybe some people didn't have people that said goodbye to them when they died. Maybe they said goodbye to their wife and went off to war, were killed, never got to say goodbye. Doesn't matter. Wife might be there to greet you when you wake up. Now, why did I give this message? What do I want you to take away from it? Well, in describing the resurrection, Paul said to comfort one another with these words. My hope is that perhaps I've brought comfort to some of you, in addition to myself, as I thought about these things in the last few weeks. Our loved ones are not dead. They are sleeping. And one of these days, God, or maybe one of his children, maybe one of us, maybe even me, will reconstruct my mother's body. Most likely not the hunched over frail one that she last had, as I said earlier, but a new one. More like how she looked when I was born, perhaps. Then her spirit can be restored to her body, breath of life put back in her, and she will wake up. And if my speculation is correct, maybe those in her family who said goodbye to her a few weeks ago will be there when she wakes. And my sister and I can say, "Hello, Mom. Here's something to eat. Let us tell you a bit about what happened after you fell asleep."